Radical honesty, damn. Don't be nervous, he said. It's good to see you. And we were off. The conversation was off the record, and I will respect that here. But suffice it to say that we had a friendly talk about the race so far, and in general, the dynamic between us. We did not discuss the specifics of his antics toward me. I had zero trust in him. I had known only his erratic, volatile behavior for months. And yet, at no point did it get tense. In fact, to a fly on the wall, we might have sounded like friends who hadn't seen each other in a long time. With total detachment, we chatted, as any reporter and candidate would. I felt no anger toward him, only confusion. How could he be so affable, given the level of anger he had sustained for so long? I tried to reconcile the person in front of me with the person I'd seen on Twitter. One warm and kind, the other very different. They didn't seem to match. I tried not to let the strangeness of the moment distract me. I was laser-focused on the mission. Get back to normalcy, personally and professionally. For months on end, Trump had been everywhere around me. Night after night, on for the full hour with Greta or Hannity, on with O'Reilly on virtually any night he attacked me. He was the GOP frontrunner. Of course he was going to be on TV. But at times, the pure saturation got tiring. Once he went on Hannity and criticized me, and I cluelessly drove our viewers to the interview. Don't miss Donald Trump coming up on Hannity. Perhaps that best conveys the professional oddity of my year of Trump. He went after me in an interview I promoted. After we'd been talking for a bit, Trump brought in his son, Eric, who was also friendly. Then he called for Ivanka and Melania to come and meet me, but they weren't in the building. He did get Ivanka on the phone, and we had a lovely exchange. I like her a lot. She and his other children reflect well on Trump. Before it was over, I asked Trump for an interview for my upcoming Fox broadcast special, and he seemed agreeable, but did not give me a date. As the meeting wound down, I felt relief, like I'd set down something heavy I'd been carrying for most of the year. Sitting at Trump Tower having a conversation with Trump felt strange, but not totally insincere. There was kindness between us in the moment. Distance, too, but kindness. I felt a bit like a hostage whose hostage taker was seeing her as a human being for the very first time, who needed to believe that he would let her go. As I got up to go, Trump asked me for my cell phone number. I hesitated. "You're not going to use it for evil, are you?" I said. "No, no," he said, "I promise." "You're not going to Lindsey Graham me, are you?" I asked him, a reference to the moment Trump publicly disclosed Senator Graham's personal cell phone number after Graham criticized him in the early primary season. "No, no, don't worry," he said. "Everyone's afraid to give me their cell phones after that." "Of course they are," I said. We laughed. I gave him the number. Trump suggested that we take a picture together. I said yes. It felt historical to me somehow. It wasn't exactly Reagan, Gorbachev, and Reykjavik, but it belonged in a time capsule for 2016. Later, I studied the picture on my phone. In it, Trump has a big smile and is flashing a thumbs up, his standard pose. His arm is around me and mine is around him. And yet we look like two people in very different places. Despite his 9-month rage against me, Trump seems to have immediately let it go, if it was ever real to begin with. His smile appears completely authentic. He had bigger things to worry about, a pressing presidential campaign and a business to run. I, on the other hand, am smiling, but it's a forced smile. I look rather like a person who's been through some sort of trauma and is waiting for the Coast Guard helicopter. When I walked out of the office, a group of people had gathered, about 7 or 8 of them, clearly staffers for Trump. The only face I recognized was that of Michael Cohen, who had retweeted "gut her" after the August debate. That tweet, more than any other, really bothered me. It was so visceral. He shot me a somewhat cold look. "Good to see you," I said. "You too," he said, and at the sound of his voice, my skin crawled a bit. He loves his boss, I told myself. That counts for something. Trump walked me to the door of his outer office suite. We shook hands goodbye, and I walked out with Keith. When I left the building, Doug was out front in the SUV. "How'd it go?" Doug asked. "It must have gone great for you to be in there that long." It did, I said. It went brilliantly. I looked at my iPhone. It was lit up. Text messages, Twitter notifications, voicemails. The news had broken of our meeting while I was inside. A producer from MSNBC had apparently seen me enter Trump Tower, and the internet was going crazy. So was my office. I hadn't told any of the management at Fox, including Roger, that I was going to this meeting, and they knew nothing about it in advance. Some later reported that Roger orchestrated the meeting. The truth is, he knew nothing about it. Roger was none too pleased that he found out from MSNBC. But I didn't care. Having the meeting take place at all, and then go well, had been too important to me to do anything that might screw it up. I had hoped to get in and out unseen, and to be the first to tell Roger about it. But the risk that someone else might break the news was worth it, if I could be sure the meeting took place without anyone getting too much in my head or in Trump's in advance. I was glad I'd kept it quiet, and the bottom line was, it worked. I was out of the shark tank. Not long after my meeting with Trump, Doug and I were at our favorite restaurant when we overheard the women next to us talking about me. One of them asked the other, not realizing I was next to her, why would she meet with him, that Megyn Kelly? What could she have been thinking? Why wouldn't I meet with him, I thought. I host a news show, and he's the Republican nominee. Am I supposed to let his behavior prevent me from doing my job? I mean, I understood the objections. While many Trump fans would later tell me they appreciated my reaching out to him, some who didn't like Trump wanted me to keep the battle going because they believed it was hurting his campaign, in particular his numbers with women. I think some also enjoyed the gladiatorial nature of it, and so they delighted in every flare-up. A few people felt that by asking for a meeting or an interview, I caved. The way I see it, I rose. I made a decision to change the story, to restore my proper place in this election, and I followed through. I was not a scorned lover intent on making a man bow to me. I was a reporter trying to cover a presidential candidate. The nature of that relationship is one of pursuit. Trump ultimately agreed to sit with me for my Fox broadcast special. As we waited for him to arrive to the interview in a conference room at Trump Tower, you could hear a pin drop. The lighting guy told me he had been so nervous he couldn't sleep the night before. I think everyone realized this could go badly. In fact, it went very well. I pressed Trump on his temperament, on the responsibility that comes with power. I asked him about his attacks on Heidi Cruz, John McCain, and others, about whether he would own up to the mistakes he'd made. I refused to let him downplay his disparaging language about women. I asked him about how American parents could teach their kids not to bully, tease, taunt, and name-call when the GOP frontrunner does all of those things. I asked him if he had ever been bullied or emotionally wounded. I found his answers fascinating. He said he really had been angry all those months. He admitted, almost too easily, that he had never really boycotted the Kelly file, despite his insistence that his fans do so. He claimed not to know he had retweeted messages calling me a bimbo. It wasn't a cage match. It was a chess move in a complex game. Not a policy interview, but an interview focused on Trump the man that would publicly end this months-long spectacle. Trump was pleased with how it turned out and seemed to finally recognize that it was time for our story to come to a close. He tweeted out, "And they all lived happily ever after." Sure enough, he stopped his relentless attacks. Some critics were disappointed. They wanted me to take down Trump, but that was never my goal or my job. Others wanted to see me play the victim, to hold him to account for what he had done to me. They didn't know me at all. By this point in my career, while I didn't enjoy the media attacks, I was largely able to dismiss them. My feelings about them had matured considerably. I now generally feel that they can only help me. Sometimes the media builds a figure up too much. When that scale gets tipped too far in favor of such a person, there's something delightful about pulling them back. I believe that if the country needs to knock you down a little, it's probably best to let them. It lets some steam out of the pressure cooker, and more humility is always good. Many people assumed I enjoyed my year of Trump. Over and over I was asked about how great it had surely been for me. Folks saw the Vanity Fair cover, and increased name recognition, and assumed it was all rainbows and unicorns. In their defense, I did not say much publicly about what it had actually been like. But some thoughtful reporters, and my friends and family, knew enough to recognize that this had been far from a glorious time. One acquaintance Doug and I saw at an event in May said it perfectly. "I'm sure this has been a hard year for you both. What a tough space to occupy." That's exactly it. A tough space to occupy, straddling the world of being the storyteller and being the story. Like Cecilia in the Woody Allen movie, The Purple Rose of Cairo, who somehow jumped into the movie screen and was stunned to find herself a part of the plot as opposed to a mere observer of it. In the end, the notion that I had it in for Trump was never more than a fiction, one that he created and the media perpetuated, but a fiction nonetheless. Some in the media held me up as a Trump foil, and Trump painted me as a nemesis, but I never wanted that, nor participated in it. Some described me as fearless throughout these events, but I wasn't. I was fearful at times, for my safety and that of my family, for what the attacks might mean to my career, my relationship with my viewers, and some of my professional relationships. And yet I knew I had a job to do, and doing it felt empowering. In showing up at Trump Tower that day, and later interviewing him for my special, I was taking control of my life, refusing to accept the status quo. Fear did come, but so did courage. If you can muster courage in the face of fear, you become more confident. You become tougher. That doesn't mean being emotionless. Clearly, I cry sometimes. I am human. But I also know how to play hurt. I have worries and insecurities just like anyone else, and yet I push through all of that in my quest to settle for more. And more can come in surprising packages. As challenging as this year has been, it's also allowed me to do all of the things so beautifully laid out in those John Denver lyrics my dad loved so much. To laugh, cry, and sing. Laughs in some of the darkest moments, thanks to my mom's sense of humor ingrained in me from birth. Occasional tears, when my own humanity would not be denied. And bouts of fear, courage, and eventually growth that have helped to make my life sing. "How have you been dealing with it?" people kept asking as the Trump drama rolled on month after month. "Well," I told them, "I've got a great husband, beautiful children, and supportive family members, friends, and coworkers, and I've had a lifetime of training." Difficulty comes to everyone, and in far greater measure than I have experienced. My situation was temporary, a stressor, a distraction, but nothing compared to real suffering. The challenge of my year of Trump was more about the folly of human interaction, and on that score I did gain some perspective. Everyone gets knocked down in life. If we put ourselves out there at all, we deal with rejection, being hated, being bullied. It's universal. You learn to handle it incident by incident. You toughen up and learn how to navigate the system. Could 22-year-old me have handled the indignities of the Trump fiasco, dealt with a leading presidential candidate talking about her bleeding, calling her a bimbo, a lightweight, a liar, crazy, sick, called for a boycott against her, and employed an attorney who encouraged 40,000 people to gut her the way 45-year-old me did? Probably not. Some of my resilience was baked in by my parents, but most has come from practice. In my law job, my TV job, my life as an American woman. Adversity is an opportunity, and one that has allowed me to flourish. It has made me stronger, my skin a little thicker. And as with any turmoil in your life, none of it is for nothing if you survive it and take stock. Imagine if I'd had no conflict prior to this, if I'd had no practice in how to shore myself up, if I had only existed in my safe space with my trigger warnings, I'd have had no means of coping. This is why the Cupcake Nation mentality, everyone's a winner, is so dangerous. When we try to protect the young from any vaguely uncomfortable ideas or encounters, we do them a grave disservice. Being tested by different viewpoints in my life, being sometimes offended or occasionally hurt or even targeted, is a big part of what prepared me for the challenges I have faced in my career, especially this past year. I had done the grueling sit-ups and my core was strong. I could withstand some gut punches. Experience gives you a folder in which to put a new upset. Ah, yes, I'm being called a bimbo by the likely Republican nominee. I will file that with my bouts of workplace sexism. I'm being bullied and people are calling me names? It's a magnified version of seventh grade. My safety is in danger because I did my job. I've been here too. It's like functioning when you're sick. You'd rather feel your best, but coughing and sneezing will not stop you from showing up. You do what makes you you, like being with your family and taking care of yourself and meeting your responsibilities, and you do it relentlessly until the crisis has passed. I've done this before. I survived, and so I know I can survive this too. One day, when I was working as a young associate for Bickel & Brewer in Chicago, I took a walk outside with my boss, Bill Brewer. We had a talk about dealing with stress, and he told me something I draw on to this day in times of trouble. Remember who you are. It sounds amorphous, but when something stressful happens to me, I often remind myself, remember who you are. In other words, what defines you? Is it this latest stressor? Or is it who you are as a person? Your relationships with your spouse, mother, father, daughter, son, sister, brother, friend, your principles. Will those things be around, even if this situation ends badly? Will you still be you? Who is that? Are you on the line? If not, then it can't be that bad. Remember who you are is the ripcord that releases me from almost any dark situation, because it reminds me that what I really value is almost never at stake. When things were at their worst in my legal career, when I was toiling away at the office, calling my own voicemail twice and hoping to break a bone on the Kennedy Expressway so I could rest for a while, I was a stranger to myself. I had lost my joy, the essence of who I was. That was how I knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I needed a change, that things could not continue as they were. Likewise, as stressful and maddening and relentless as the situation with Trump became, it was only in that moment of powerless resignation that this odd reality finally affected my sense of self. That was when I knew, once and for all, I had to act. There is no historical precedent for Trump or for how this election played out, but there is plenty of precedent in my own life for going through difficulty and coming out the other side a little stronger. And unlike the other rough eras to date, being bullied, losing my father, getting divorced, I am coming out of this one with a beautiful, healthy family, work I love, and colleagues and friends I adore. Most of all, I'm coming out of it having remembered who I am as a person, woman, mother, wife, daughter, sister, friend, and professional. Within hours of Trump's becoming the presumptive Republican nominee in May 2016, Hillary Clinton and groups supporting her released several attack ads showing moments in the Trump campaign in which he had behaved outrageously, especially toward women. Quotes about or pictures of me appeared in many of them. Watching these ads, I was struck again by how surreal this year had been, how much less fun it is to be the news than to cover it. And it occurred to me that this was exactly what my debate question foretold: his words about women being used against him in the general election. It had been, in other words, an important and prescient question. I knew a year earlier that this exact montage was coming. I just never imagined that I would end up in it. Chapter 24. Paying It Forward. By July 2016, things had calmed down a bit in my life. Trump had stopped the nonsense. He and Hillary Clinton had secured their party's respective nominations, and I was getting ready for the Republican and Democratic national conventions. And then, another national news story began to unfold in my life. Roger Ailes was sued for sexual harassment. The lawsuit was filed by Gretchen Carlson, an anchor whom Fox had just fired. Most of us had never seen such a complaint before, because our Fox contracts require us to arbitrate disputes in a private forum, so public lawsuits against the boss were unheard of. The majority of my colleagues dismissed the allegations as those of a disgruntled employee, but I had a different reaction. The story sounded very familiar to me because it had happened to me years earlier. It started in the summer of 2005, when I was called up to New York, shortly after Britt Hume had told me I'd captured the attention of Mr. Ailes. I had been with the company for just under a year. I was still a neophyte in the D.C. Bureau, working the 5 a.m. shift and plenty of weekends. By this point, I had figured out that Roger was not a politically correct guy. He would often make off-color jokes or comments about people, politics, pretty much any subject. This was not a secret in the industry. Roger was praised publicly by many writers who found his provocative style amusing. At times, his humor could be over the top, but it didn't bother me much. I'd worked in rough-and-tumble office settings before and had never been one to word-police my colleagues. However, Roger began pushing the limits well beyond humor, beyond anything I'd experienced, introducing explicit sexual innuendo into our conversations. At first, it was just a comment here or there, but over the next 6 months, the remarks would get more frequent and more direct, and then he made physical advances toward me. As with others I have since learned about, there was a pattern to his behavior. I would be called into Roger's office, he would shut the door, and over the next hour or two, he would engage in a kind of cat-and-mouse game with me, veering between obviously inappropriate sexually charged comments, for example, about the very sexy bras I must have and how he'd like to see me in them, and legitimate professional advice. This is part of what made it so complicated. It wasn't all a come-on. He also gave helpful work-related counsel, such as his suggestion about showing the audience my real self. But there would always be a stinger, and they got more explicit and disturbing over time. I kept a record of Roger's behavior and have since shared the facts with those who investigated the case against him. I see no point in making all of the details public, but suffice it to say, he made sexual comments to me, offers of professional advancement in exchange for sexual favors, and eventually, physical attempts to be with me, every single one of which I rejected. I tried to laugh off the inappropriate comments, or pretend not to understand them, or to redirect the conversation to something work-related, but I was deeply concerned. It was an upsetting, impossible dynamic. Here was this man, my boss, on the cover of industry magazines as the most powerful man in news. A man whose good opinion I desperately wanted, who could make or break my budding television career. I was beyond happy to be working there. I had finally achieved my dream. The last thing I wanted was this kind of monkey wrench thrown into our relationship. I wanted him to like me professionally, and for him to help develop my career based only on my work performance. But he was trying to change the stakes for my advancement. And when that realization became inescapable, I felt a surge of panic. Early on, I was still hoping it would end without confrontation. After all, I was in D.C. and only got up to New York every month or so. Perhaps he'll lose interest, I thought. Perhaps he'll get the hint. I was also bewildered he would take such risks with someone he barely knew. I am an attorney. How could he be so reckless? Surely, I figured, he would eventually knock it off. But in January 2006, Roger called me up to New York and we had a shocking exchange. I was nervous about going into his office, concerned he might start in again. Sure enough, he did. And then he crossed a new line, trying to grab me repeatedly and kiss me on the lips. I dodged the first two attempts, pushed him away, and immediately went to leave. His office was large, and it took me a beat to get to the door, which was closed. As I walked away from him, he followed me and asked me an ominous question. When is your contract up? And then, for the third time, he tried to kiss me. I dodged him again and walked out, upset, rattled, and angry. There was no more trying to deny his intentions. I knew I had a very real problem on my hands. Earlier, Roger had made sure I knew the stakes, telling me, I don't like to fight, but when I do, I fight to kill. The message could not have been clearer. If you tell anyone, I will destroy you. He easily could have. He was merciless to his enemies, and Roger called all the shots at Fox. He had set up the management such that everyone was completely devoted to him. Loyalty was prized above everything. It was a prerequisite of working for him. It was well known that those who crossed him would soon be at the receiving end of planted hit pieces in the press. Look at what happened to Paula Zahn. He publicly humiliated her. He sued her. He tried to end her career, just for wanting to go to CNN. And she was established. She had power. But Roger had more, and was not afraid to use it. He was well-liked by most in the building, and well-connected to everyone in the industry. And me? I wasn't connected at all, and I loved my job and didn't want to lose it. I left Roger's office that day and went directly to LaGuardia Airport to catch the shuttle home. I hadn't even walked in before I called Willis Goldsmith, then the partner in charge of Jones Day's employment law practice, who agreed to represent me. I paced back and forth outside the terminal as he walked me through my options, most of which I already knew and none of which was ideal. I realized Roger had crossed a line, but I had handled it without doing anything. I didn't want to sue. I didn't want to blow this up. Like most sexual harassment targets, I just wanted it to stop. I felt better having a lawyer in case Roger retaliated against me for rejecting him, but I knew the reality of the situation. If I caused a stink, my career would likely be over. Sure, they might investigate, but I felt certain there was no way they would get rid of him, and I would be left on the wrong side of the one man who had power at Fox. I'd get labeled a troublemaker, someone who is overly sensitive, all the things we too often hear about women who don't tolerate harassment. I didn't want any of that. I just wanted to do my job. At the time, I wondered if I was the first or only target of Roger's advances. He was so brazen about it, I had the distinct feeling he had done it before. I wrestled with the idea of keeping quiet. On the one hand, what if I said nothing and he did this to someone else? On the other hand, this was not the first time a male superior had come on to me, and I had no proof that Roger was a serial harasser. I tried to raise the issue with a female anchor who had been there longer than I had, to see if it had ever happened to her. She said she and Roger had always had a strictly professional relationship. I shared some of the details with my office mate, Major Garrett, who was stunned and had never heard of Roger behaving that way. And then, after much soul-searching, I decided I needed to bring the matter to a supervisor, which I did. That person, who I have no wish to ensnare in a press melee by naming here, vouched for Roger's character, suggested he was likely just smitten, and recommended that I try to avoid him, which I hadn't realized was actually an option. To this day, I don't know whether this person pressed the matter further up the line at Fox, though no one ever contacted me. I figured I had managed to avoid compromising myself, and if I could steer clear of Roger for a while and get him to leave me alone, we could pretend the whole thing never happened, and I could get back to doing what I really wanted to do, reporting the news. And so, for the next several months, I did my best to avoid him. I offered excuses for why I couldn't swing by his office while in New York. I dodged his phone calls, and then returned his messages after hours when I knew he wouldn't be there. Major would see my phone repeatedly light up with the boss's name, me, a second-year reporter, and we'd share a look of astonishment. I threw myself into work in the DC Bureau, and there was plenty of it. This was around the time of the Duke Lacrosse case, and tried to be so good that Roger couldn't ignore me, professionally, even if he felt spurned personally. By the following summer, the stalker had entered my life, and on that matter, Roger was appropriate and supportive. I also met and fell in love with Doug, a fact I was sure to mention to anyone who asked, including Roger. By the fall of 2006, the Fox management team held that off-site meeting, and Roger's top executives proposed pairing me with Hemmer for America's Newsroom. Lo and behold, Roger offered me the job. I moved to New York in January 2007, and Roger never sexually harassed me again. For the next 9 years, we had a professional relationship, in which he was, for the most part, a supportive boss, who mentored and looked out for me. He gave me the chance to prove myself. He promoted me during my maternity leaves. He and his wife, Beth, had me and Doug to their home for dinner parties. I got to know his son, and I filed his earlier behavior away as a passing infatuation by a man who I assumed had been having some marital difficulty. As time went by, I always wondered if there were other women who had had similar experiences with Roger. Years later, I met one. A friend confessed that Roger had come on to her during her job interview, not long before my own exchange with him. She did not submit to his advances, and, as in my case, he did not retaliate. She got the job. She had moved past the incident and certainly did not want it revealed or turned into a legal matter. But I resolved then and there that if I heard of him doing this to another woman, I would again come forward. In 2012, I learned that a reporter for New York Magazine was writing a book about Roger. This reporter was no fan of Fox News, and certainly not of Roger's, and Roger became very focused on the project. He seemed to live in constant fear of it. He was so agitated about the book, I began to wonder whether he had something to hide, whether the harassment my friend and I had experienced was perhaps more pervasive. I discussed the issue with Brian Lewis, then the head of Fox PR and an executive vice president at Fox. I knew I was not at liberty to discuss my friend's incident, so I was careful in my choice of words. I confided to him that I believed Roger might have been inappropriate with women at Fox. Brian had never heard of such a thing. When the book came out, it hit Roger on every subject imaginable, but included only one notable reference to an inappropriate incident with a woman from 30 years earlier. Even a reporter devoted to exposing Roger offered no hint that Roger was a serial harasser. I felt reassured that he wasn't what I'd feared, that my superior's defense of him years earlier was sound. In the years that followed, Roger hit his mid-70s, fell into ill health, began using a walker for a time, and was in and out of the office for medical treatments. When I saw him, our conversations revolved mostly around my show or our families. My life was busy, and I never gave much additional thought to the matter. However, in the back of my mind, I still wondered whether another woman might someday come forward. Then came Gretchen's lawsuit. When I first saw her complaint, despite my having been targeted by Roger, I felt ambivalent. I knew enough about Gretchen's tenure at Fox to know that executives other than Roger had long had issues with her performance, fairly or not. I wasn't discounting the possibility that she may have been harassed, but I wasn't entirely sure what to believe. Fox News' parent company, 21st Century Fox, quickly weighed in, announcing its full confidence in Roger, which came as no surprise. It also said, however, that it would conduct a review of the allegations. The scope of that review and who would be performing it was not addressed. Almost immediately, three other women came forward to the Daily Beast, which identified them only as former Fox News employees. The details of their stories rang disturbingly true to me. I felt sick upon reading them. The questions pulsed through my mind. Is this who he is? Did he truly never stop? And how many others are there? Roger denied the allegations and immediately began getting his ducks in a row, commencing an intense campaign inside of Fox News to get the talent to speak out publicly on his behalf. I was approached several times, and several times I refused. There was no way I was going to lie to protect him. When I refused, he engineered hit pieces about me online, which cited Fox News insiders to suggest that I was being selfish for not defending him or looking to improve my brand by having a feminist moment. It wasn't true, and it didn't work. I understood my colleagues wanting to defend Roger, since loyalty was an absolute job requirement. So was saying nice things about Roger. Indeed, failing to compliment him enthusiastically in any press interview would always result in a rebuke. Many, including me, had experienced years of kindness from him. Roger was very good at cultivating the fealty he demanded. Most genuinely did not believe he was capable of that kind of behavior, although they did not know the experiences others had been subjected to behind closed doors. The biggest downside to the PR campaign was the pressure it put on the victims, to whom the message was loud and clear. We're with Roger. If you speak out, no one will believe you. They were already afraid of Roger, and now they were worried about the major talent, too. Would they be booked on this person's show again? Would they be publicly branded liars or ingrates by some of the best-known names in news? And what about Roger? What stories would he engineer about us? How would he try to discredit us? How would he punish us without putting his fingerprints on it? When the allegations hit, no one thought Roger would get fired, including me. Crossing him was a major risk, especially because Roger's emissaries were telling us we need not participate in the investigation and made it clear we were facing a loyalty test. I was aware that my silence would speak volumes, but there was no way I was going to lie, especially when I might be called as a witness in the lawsuit against him or questioned in an internal review. I also wanted women who may have experienced similar behavior from him not to feel alone or feel pressure from someone like me. Some would later tell me they felt relieved I did not speak out in his defense. It gave them permission to make the same choice. This was an intense time. Information was breaking daily. My phone was ringing nonstop, with colleagues trying to get my take, provide information, or pressure me into publicly backing the boss. I was still doing my show nightly, preparing for the conventions, finishing this book, or so I thought, and taking care of my children. The developments came rapid fire, and I felt desperate for a quiet moment to gather my thoughts and decide what my next steps would be. I spoke to my friend at Fox, who had also been harassed. She was as resolved as I that she would not lie. She and I agreed to quietly get the word out to other women who hadn't spoken out that we were prepared to go on the record with the investigators so they would not fear standing alone. This took a lot of guts from my friend, who has little power at Fox. If she confided in the wrong person, her disloyalty would surely have gotten back to Roger. She was a fearless soldier in what would become an underground army of women, those resolved to be honest about his behavior. Still, resolving to tell the truth and actually doing it were two different things. The stakes were very high. Our jobs were potentially in danger, and Roger was digging in for a fight. And then, something critical happened. A source informed me that Roger was working to limit the review to just a small circle of staffers, those who had worked directly with Gretchen. He wanted the net cast very narrowly, to exclude virtually all of the Fox News talent. I knew what that would likely mean. It was then that I realized I had a choice to make. I could sit back, let the process play out, limited though it might be, and keep my mouth shut. Or I could ensure that the owners of Fox News Channel, Rupert Murdoch and his sons, understood they might actually have a predator running their company, and that a full-throated review was necessary. It may sound like a no-brainer now, with 20/20 hindsight, but in the moment, I felt more anxious than I'd imagined I would. Telling the truth to an investigator who might come to me was one thing. Ensuring the investigators got to me, and to other Fox talent, was another. The passive role felt more obligatory. An active one raised the stakes considerably. As of that early date in the process, I had my suspicions, but I didn't actually know what the truth was. The allegations online at that point were anonymous and undated. I knew of my story and that of my friend, but these were events from a decade earlier. Was I really prepared to get him in trouble for something we had long since gotten past? To undermine this man who had done so much for my career and who had my back in some ugly situations? I didn't want to hurt him, but could I stay silent? What if there were other victims? What if, God forbid, he was still doing it to someone? The choice became clear. Honor my ethical code or abide by my loyalty to Roger. There was no way to do both. I had a long talk about it with Doug, who supported my coming forward but made clear he was with me whatever my decision. And then I spoke with Dana Perino, who had just finished an advance copy of this book. "What did that cameraman, Bon Lee, say to you in Chicago?" she asked. "Pay it forward," I told her. "Pay it forward," she repeated back to me. I put down the phone and sat there for a long time. I glanced over at the draft manuscript. Settle for more. The next morning, as I sat on my porch swing on the Jersey Shore, I looked at some pictures of my children. There was one of my favorites, of Yardley. In it, she is on top of a jungle gym, wearing a big smile and a white dress with red polka dots and sneakers. Her long hair is falling forward, her blonde summer highlights shining in the sun. A month earlier, she had fallen off the monkey bars and gotten stitches in her head. But she had conquered her fear and gotten back up there. My child, who will take this world by storm. My girl, who I pray will not have to make the same choices I did. My daughter, who deserved to have her mother stand up and say, "This man will not do this to another woman at Fox News. Ever." I picked up the phone and called Lachlan Murdoch. "You need to get your general counsel on the phone," I told him. "I have something to tell you." And he did. And then I told them the truth about what had happened to me all those years ago. It was hard. I was not looking to ruin Roger, but it was obvious this information would be damaging to him. In the end, however, I concluded that if Roger were taken down by an honest review of his conduct, it would be his responsibility, not mine. If mine were an isolated incident, he likely had nothing to fear. If it were part of an ongoing pattern, he would have only himself to blame for his undoing. 20 years after I had refused to copy another case at Bickle & Brewer, I had again run headfirst into the realization that I had just one path forward. Within days of that call, to its credit, 21st Century announced that it had hired the well-respected law firm of Paul Weiss to investigate Roger's conduct. As soon as Paul Weiss commenced its work, I was asked to and did appear at their law offices, where I told my story to the lawyers. The harassment during that 6-month period at Fox, and the 9 years of support and mentorship that followed. I wanted them to have the full measure of the man, the good, along with the bad. Soon after, Roger was informed that I had gone on the record against him, something I had accepted would happen. By that point, I had become aware of many other victims. The underground soldiers were finding each other, including some women who were still being harassed by him in deeply unsettling ways. I figured if sharing my name with Roger would help the others stay anonymous, so be it. The next thing I knew, someone leaked my name to the press as one of Roger's accusers. It was stunning and alarming to see such a private matter splashed all over the internet. I had no wish to make my situation a public matter. Simultaneously, Roger tried to discredit me, getting the Drudge Report to print the lie that my complaint was all about a hug I didn't like. Some of my colleagues who loved Roger felt angry believing that story, believing I, and only I, had chosen to hurt him over what he claimed was nothing. I stayed silent, trusting that the truth would soon come out, and knowing that even if it didn't, I had followed my conscience. The upside of being outed was that more women reached out to me, current and former employees with nearly identical texts and messages. "Megan, it happened to me too." Getting on the wrong side of Roger was nerve-wracking. I was well aware of his vengeful streak. But the truth is, I was lucky. By this point in my career, Roger could not destroy me. That was not necessarily true for the other women who went on the record, all of whom were incredibly brave. Most were current Fox News employees, still dependent on him for their paychecks, many with families to support. Some were very young and very scared, with little ability to fight a smear campaign or to move to a new shop, which is especially tricky in TV news. They, too, had been pressured to protect Roger. And yet somehow, they found the courage to risk it all. They want their anonymity, and I will respect their wishes. But as a result, they will never get the credit they deserve. All I can say is, I am incredibly proud of each and every one of them. On July 21st, 2016, as I sat in Cleveland, preparing for the Republican National Convention, I learned that Roger Ailes had been effectively fired, 20 years after he co-founded Fox News. Just like that, this man, who to me had been such a confounding mix of supportive, generous, infuriating, and cruel, was gone. Rupert Murdoch took over as acting chairman with his sons, Lachlan and James, at his side. And the Fox News Channel, in a way, began anew. My colleagues at the convention were stunned and upset by the news. I was surrounded by turmoil and some resentment. I was also surrounded by security guards, who escorted me in and out of the convention hall quickly and without stopping each night. The evening of the Ailes announcement, a woman and her daughter happened to catch my eye. The security tried to press past them, but I wanted to stop. The mother told me her daughter was a big fan. I put my arm around the young teen for a picture, only to realize she was crying, overwhelmed. I turned and held her for a long time, tears spilling from her eyes and then welling up in my own. I don't think I realized how much I needed that reminder that while there may be an obvious cost to doing what you think is right, there are also real, though perhaps less visible, benefits. My relationships with a few colleagues changed after these events, but for the most part, once people found out what Roger had been doing to the women of the company, which, as has now been publicly reported, was far more serious, sustained, pervasive, and disturbing than I could have imagined, many reached out to me. I was touched, but not surprised. My friends at Fox are decent and kind. Most didn't mean to join some pressure campaign. They just misjudged a confusing situation. I received many messages from friends and colleagues, including, once again, my beloved audio tech, Dion, who wrote me before anyone else did. I felt especially close to the victims, with whom I had an unusual bond. We had all been through it, we had all felt powerless to stop it, and eventually, despite enormous pressure, we had all told the truth. I wish I could tell you I now have the solution that would prevent this from happening at another company, but I don't have it all figured out. One thing I would like to see is every corporation with a compliance director who does not depend on the CEO for his or her paycheck, who could receive reports about the boss like these, an ombudsman of sorts. But would that make the victims actually call? I honestly don't know. I want to believe the answer is yes. I think the culture is changing a bit. It's already different from how it had been a decade ago when Roger was harassing me. Back then, the papers were full of reports, like that of the American Apparel CEO, who had severely sexually harassed his female staff, and after paying off a few lawsuits, was allowed to run the company for another 10 years. In 2016, when Roger's behavior was brought to their attention, the Murdochs acted quickly and honorably. Despite Roger's attempts to pre-wire it, the Paul Weiss Review was not a whitewash. They were genuinely searching for the truth. When they found it, they knew Roger had to go. Sure, he was promised a separation payment, but he was cut loose and, more important, cut off from the women of Fox News. Roger's harassment of women wasn't a deal-breaker for everyone. It was widely reported that Trump used him as a campaign advisor. Many reporting on the Roger situation seemed to revel in the fall of a conservative giant. Some also seemed to forget about the humanity of his victims, resorting to victim blaming or shaming. Perhaps it was the Fox News connection, but questions surfaced a little too frequently, asking why these women didn't just quit, why it took them so long to come forward, and why, for that matter, they chose to look so alluring on the air. This was infuriating to many of us. Aren't we well past the days of her skirt was so short she invited her own harassment drivel? Most of the women in TV news are attractive, wear form-fitting dresses, and have their hair and makeup professionally done. Some wear no sleeves, dresses above the knee, and false eyelashes. That doesn't make them partners in their own harassment, as some suggested. It makes them broadcasters who want to look great when appearing in front of millions of people. For what it's worth, when I was being harassed, I was still wearing my Jones Day outfits, navy, black, and gray business suits with long sleeves and pants. And when I got bolder in my wardrobe choices, Roger never bothered me. As for the attempts to blame the victims for not speaking out sooner, it is management's job, not that of the employees, to ensure that a company has ethical leaders who comply with the law, and to make certain that women feel safe to report any incident. That did not happen at Fox, and I suspect Fox is not alone. Roger maintained complete control at FNC, over the talent, the management, everyone. Not only did these women fear for their jobs, they feared being attacked by his PR and legal teams. They feared his many loyalists throughout the company who had risen to positions of authority but were protective only of him. This was a man who reportedly used private investigators and others internally to go after suspected enemies. He kept us all under careful watch, with security cameras and security locks requiring a Fox ID on every floor, guards patrolling the halls, and provisions in our contracts agreeing that our office communications may be monitored. This is standard practice at many shops. The point is, reporting about the boss, anonymously or otherwise, had daunting challenges at Fox. His victims, who I would later learn were typically vulnerable in some way, new to the company, going through a divorce, or having suffered a death in the family, were in an untenable situation. The entire structure was set up to isolate and silence them. Even those of us who did take the risk of reporting his behavior up the line didn't manage to effect any change. The bottom line is, the more we criticize harassment victims for their understandable reluctance to go on the record, the more women we will shame into silence forever. The thoughts I am left with are these. Having meaningful controls in place to encourage reporting is critical. Controls that account for employees' legitimate fear of coming after a powerful superior, especially a CEO. Having managers in place who understand their own responsibilities upon receiving such a report is equally important. Sexual harassment training may help. It gives businesses some cover if they get sued, but it is far from a cure-all. We had it many times at Fox. Clearly, it wasn't enough. As for the employees, there is strength in numbers. Women who have been harassed need to communicate with their colleagues, in particular their fellow women. Men, too, can be harassed, and the same advice applies to them. One of the scariest things is thinking you are the only one, and fearing the task of taking on a king. If one's budget allows, retaining counsel may also help. Without Willis Goldsmith, I would have felt far less protected. Finally, anyone being harassed needs to remember that no is an available answer. Roger tried to have me, and I didn't let him. I got out of his office with my self-respect intact, even if I felt demeaned. Most women I know have had to do this dance with a male superior at one point, trying to reject inappropriate behavior while also trying to avoid explicitly calling him out. But when push comes to shove, no is always there for you. It is not foolproof, as sadly any sexual assault or rape survivor can attest, but when dealing with a boss whose goal is not to forcibly overtake you, but instead to see how far he can push you, it may offer an escape hatch. You may be flying the beautiful F-16, sleek and shiny and a powerhouse in the air, but when fire hits the cockpit, there's always the eject button to remove you from immediate danger. Get out of that room, get somewhere safe, and get help in the form that works best for you. I worked my tail off for the next 10 years. I established myself as a serious person. I built my own power. And when the allegations about Roger hit, I used it. Perhaps there is some poetic justice in that. Times are changing for women in this country. We're putting up with less, standing up for ourselves more, and making strides some never thought possible. 1 week after Roger Ailes resigned, I watched as former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton became the first woman in U.S. history to accept a major party's presidential nomination. In an arena in Philadelphia, her daughter, Chelsea, introduced her, the two women embracing on stage. Mrs. Clinton then let go of her daughter, turned to the cheering crowd, and began. Chapter 25, Settling for More Today. Recently, I took the kids to visit my mom in Albany. During our stay, she taught them to gamble, trash talk, and curse, and told them a horrifying story about a little child who goes swimming in the ocean and is eaten by a shark. She also suggested they start calling her Beautiful Grandmama in a British accent, though she said Beautiful Nana would suffice in a pinch. They're mulling it over. While sitting at the dining room table working on this book, I watched over my laptop as my mom accused Yates of cheating at Monopoly and then told him Yates is great. Cue Yates's big smile. She went on, but not as great as his Nana. Cue bigger smiles, his and mine. Oh, beautiful grandmama. Sitting there watching them play, I smiled, thinking of how the Kelly family marches on. Nana, at age 100, finally agreed she might need some help taking care of things, so she moved in with my mom and Peter. They're treating me like Lady Horseshit, Nana tells me. Being Lady Horseshit is apparently a good thing. Patrick's daughter Susan got married. Peter walked her down the aisle in a beautiful outdoor ceremony. As she said her vows, the clouds above parted for a beat, and the sun shone down upon her. Liza later said, I knew my brother would find a way to say hello. It's the end of what, by any measure, has been an extraordinary year. I've had many new experiences, some bad, some good. A few new party invitations came my way, including the Vanity Fair Oscar party and the Met Gala. Before the Oscar party, Doug and I went to a night before party in the Hollywood Hills. The home belongs to actress Helen Mirren, but was being rented by Absolute Vodka. The decorations were exquisite. There were tiny red lanterns, white lights, white and red flowers, and votive candles everywhere. There were also synchronized swimmers wearing 1950s-style bathing suits because, hey, why not? They had flown in an award-winning bartender from London. I asked the host what one orders from such a bartender, and he said, I recommend you just go over there and tell him what kind of a day you've had. Off I went. The tall, blonde British barkeep, who was throwing glasses in the air like a juggler, stopped to ask what he could get me. Well, I said, I've had a shit year. I'm exhausted, but I'm here in L.A. with my husband, and it feels like my first night off in a decade. What do you have for that? For the record, Absolute Elix, Citrus, and Earl Grey Tea. It was a kick meeting people whose faces I had seen on the big screen, or whose music I listened to, people whose work I admired. Meeting Taylor Swift was especially fun. She called me a powerful woman. I said the same to her. Then I realized I'm old enough to be her mother. Another Absolute Elix, please. Given that when I'm not at the anchor desk, I'm usually in jeans and a t-shirt, I enjoyed dressing up. I chose my Met Gala dress just a couple of days before the party. Busy with work, I was forced by my assistant to make a call on the offerings she had arranged to have waiting in my office. Mom offered to lend me a dress she had just bought for herself at Fashion Bug, where I also used to shop in Del Mar. It's black with sequins on it. And of course, she said, I look stunning in it. Instead, I picked a black sheath with a metallic back by Badgley Mischka. The day of the gala, I went to their salon. The designer, Rob, told me to try it on and said Badgley and Mischka would be out to take a look. Is that a joke? I wondered. I had no idea if they were actual people, never mind alive and in this salon at that moment. They are indeed real people. An interesting thing happened to me on the party circuit. Taking in these A-list, star-studded events, I realized something. They're not life-changing. They're fancy parties with lots of famous people, period. And no matter how famous they are, they're still just people. And I'm still me, the girl from Albany who wonders whenever someone recognizes me on the street, why are they looking at me? Do Do I have something stuck in my teeth? These parties are like Saks Fifth Avenue at Christmas time, a visual delight, full of glitter and twinkling lights. The displays are mind-blowing in their no-expenses-spared extravagance. But returning home to a comfy room with a fire burning, watching a favorite old movie, or playing Pie Face with my kids is pretty damn good, too. This is an actual game, involving a face full of whipped cream. My brother Pete ought to be getting royalties. Often, I feel like a fish out of water in all that fabulousness. It's not that I don't like being there. It's just that it doesn't quite jibe with who I know I really am. The tomboy on the tire swing. Thankfully, I have plenty of help staying humble. Not long ago, I was in a restaurant with my friend Susan Lucci. We went to the ladies' room together. A woman in the bathroom could not believe she was laying eyes upon Susan. "Oh my God, Susan Lucci!" this woman exclaimed. "I love you! I have never missed an episode of All My Children. I love Erica Kane. Oh, I cannot believe this." Susan was her normal, kind self, smiling and thanking her fan. Then the woman lost her smile, gave me the side eye, and said flatly, "I know who you are, too." My Albany Law School theory of life. Just when you think you're some sort of hotshot, life has a way of reminding you, yeah, not so much. I would not describe this past year as easy, but I have no regrets about it either. I did my job, and controversy followed. At Fox News, I honored my ethics and paid it forward to the women coming up behind me, despite the risks of doing so. These events, very public and painful, tested me, and I survived. In fact, I was strengthened. They brought me and Doug even closer together and reminded me of what's important in life. Unlike when I was younger and tried to go it alone, I leaned on those around me, often. Now those relationships are closer, too. I was reminded that what M'lady Amy said was true. There may be some cads in the world, but good men really are out there in abundance. I have them on my team, and I also happen to have three of them right in my apartment. When I look at my husband, I think, as my old friend Maureen used to say, that's a real man. Not just because he is smart and strong. It's because he's decent and good. Doug is a loving, involved father who respects me and our children and the life we are building together. That is the kind of partner I want to have. The kind of partner I want Yardley to meet someday. The kind of man I know our two sons will become. Recently, Doug and I had a particularly great day with the kids. One of those days with so much laughter and adventure, the kind that makes you feel like you want to stop time and just live that day over and over. "It's too bad Thatcher isn't old enough to remember this day," Doug said to me after we put the kids to bed. "It's all ingredients into the cake," I said. Our little boy might not remember the details of what we did, how pretty the weather was, how sweetly his big brother and sister played with him, how his mom and dad held him, but all that warmth and love is going somewhere. Those experiences are making him the child and the man he will be. The same is true of any human being. You can use the difficult times to shore yourself up, to prove to yourself you can handle anything, or you can lament your bad luck and cry in your soup about life being unfair. One is productive, and the other, most certainly, is not. Tough times can be stressful, but they also have a way of centering us, of shining a light through the darkness. I learned this after the death of my father, which gave me a consciousness of my own mortality, and that has led to better choices. Knowing how little time we have has helped force me to pull myself out of sadness, debt, emotional armor, and a job and marriage I knew were not good enough. I have found a career that excites me, a husband I deeply love and respect, true friendships, and three beautiful children whose joy, love, and zest for life have brought those same things and so much more into my own. It's given me the gift of ambition, not for money or power or fame, but for more. More human connection, more goodness, more time. The hard times remind you it is possible to change your life. to do better, to be better, to settle for more. But settle for more is not a one-time thing. It's not like you redesign your life and then sit back and say, nailed it, done. It's a framework for looking at life long-term and finding opportunities to make things better. And what more means at age 25 is different from what it means at 45, when you're starting out in your career versus when you're established, when you're single and unmarried versus when you're married with children. Likewise, as I sat back and watched my mom and my kids play games in my mother's dining room, it occurred to me that settling for more at 45 would be different than at 75, my mom's age. Whatever age I am, I thought to myself, I will always settle for more of this. More games with my children, more laughs, more fun. That's what I need. It's what fuels me. And lately, I haven't had enough of it. So that's something I'll be working on in the months to come. And I know I will find the balance. Today, I look at the future and see unlimited opportunity for more meaningful time with my family, more work I find fulfilling, and always more John Denver. I'll be a dandy and I'll be a rover. You'll know who I am by the songs that I sing. I'll feast at your table. I'll sleep in your clover. Who cares what the morrow shall bring? This is Megan Kelly. This production of Settle for More was produced and directed by Scott Sherritt, a good guy who gave me a lot of coaching on how to read this book, which is very different than reading for TV. And recorded at CDM Studios in New York City by Tyler Whitlatch, who says nothing during the taping, but is an interesting man. Sorry. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Post-production by Danny Meltzer. Music by Bob Stander. Text copyright 2016 by MK2.0 LLC. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved, meaning if you try to steal this, we will sue you. Thanks for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.